accession number 28921, real one.
Project director of the Holocaust exhibition here. And it's my great pleasure to outline how the form of this evening and also to introduce two special guests. Firstly, I'd like to introduce Kitty Hart, the subject of this evening's film. She will be joining us on the platform later on. Kitty Hart was really a pioneer in writing about her experiences. She published her book, I Am Alive, back in 1961, one of the really very, very early personal memoirs about the experience of living through the Holocaust. And since that time, she's done an enormous amount to help to keep the history of that time alive, going into schools, working with the Holocaust Education Trust. She took part, obviously, in the documentary which you're going to see this evening and contributed to another TV program called Another Journey by Train, some of you may know, in 1993. In 1998, Kitty Hart agreed to be interviewed by October Films for the Holocaust exhibition here. And since then, very nearly a million people have listened to her story and that of all the other survivor witnesses in the Holocaust exhibition. So we owe a great debt of gratitude to Kitty for taking part in that enterprise and for really bequeathing her memories of that time to our exhibition. And secondly, our other special guest is Peter Morley, the director of the film that you're going to see and who will shortly be introducing it. Peter Morley has had a very varied career mainly in television documentaries as editor, writer, and director. Many of the subjects he's dealt with have actually been very close to this museum's field of interest. I was looking at the list of films that he had made, and several of them were familiar to me. In particular, I noticed The First Casualty, a film that was made in 1970 about First World War propaganda. In another job, I worked in the education department here, and that was very regularly screened to schools in this cinema for many, many years. And Peter Morley also made one of the first hour-long documentaries on Hitler as early as 1959, just 14 years after the end of the Nazi regime. Other films and series which he directed include Europe, the Mighty Continent, and then in the late 1970s, his acclaimed Women of Courage series, of which Kitty Hart's story was a part. And Peter Morley continues to be, I think he has a name for being highly innovative in his filmmaking career. He continues to be highly innovative, and I gather he has, in the 1980s, pioneered the first interactive video discs in the UK, and I think continues to work in that field now, or rather in DVDs. Just to outline the format of this evening, Peter Morley will be introducing the film shortly, and then we will watch it. Then there will be time for questions, and Kitty Hart and Peter Morley and myself and Toby Haggith from our film department will be on the platform here to answer questions. And then we'll go out into the atrium where there will be more drinks. Could I just ask you at this stage, if any of you have got mobiles, could you just make sure that they're switched off, please? And now it's my great pleasure to ask Peter Morley to come and introduce the film. Thank you very much.
I'm going to try and sketch in the background to why this film was made, how it was made, how it first... I hope it's one of ours. It was terrible. And how I met Kitty and so on. In 1978, I was asked by Yorkshire Television to come on board and make a series of documentaries which, as you've just heard, they were called Women of Courage. And I joined them. And Kevin Sim, who was in charge of the research to find candidates for this series. He went off. He later became my associate producer on the films that we made. And to find candidates for that series. And we'd laid down certain rules that would qualify people. They had to be, obviously, mature adult women. They had to come from different countries, and each one of them should have taken on the role on their own to fight the Nazi regime and everything that it stood for. So that really was the concept of the series. So they went off and found candidates, and I was working on something else at the moment, and when I was free, I saw the list that they had prepared of potential people to take part, and they bombarded me with synopses of their stories, and each one, of course, was absolutely tremendous. So there was that sad situation where one had to decide which stories not to tell. And I then went and met a lot of these people all over the world to make that final decision. But one of the names which came up was Kitty Hart, an Auschwitz survivor. And when I saw that, and I saw the synopsis of what she'd been through, I thought it was tremendous. It would no doubt be a very good program, but it didn't fit into the Women of Courage, because all these people were mature ladies who'd taken the decision to fight the regime. And here was Kitty, who was still 12 years old when World War II started. And she was engulfed by events in her small town, Bielsko, in Poland, and didn't really fit in to Women of Courage. So that immediately alerted me to the fact that probably we will have to drop that idea and not make that program. Anyway, I wanted to see her because I was so intrigued by what I'd read about her. And so I went up to meet her for the first time. She had settled in this country with her mother, the only survivor of that family from Bielsko, the only survivors. And both had been through Auschwitz, and they settled in Birmingham to start a new life. And I went to see her with some trepidation, knowing that probably I will not be able to make this film. And so in her living room, you know, we broke the ice and started talking, and she must have spotted me, my eyes fixing on something on the mantelpiece, and she went over there and brought it to me and showed it to me. And it was a little Perspex display case, very small one. And inside it were mounted two pieces of skin, and each one had a number on it. The number of her mother and the number of her. These were the Auschwitz tattoo identification numbers, which she decided they ought to be removed, and they were removed. And there they were on the mantelpiece, acting as, if you like, a constant reminder of what they'd been through. And then we had lunch, and I remember she ceremonially cut a slice from a loaf of bread, and then looking at me, and she held up this slice, and she said, "This is the one slice, the Auschwitz daily slice of bread, the bread ration. If you didn't have your bread ration, you were dead. If you had your bread ration, you had a chance to survive, because you either ate it, or you bargained with it, or you bribed with it, but without it, you were dead." So I knew that I was going to be in for an interesting time when I heard all this. And then we talked a great deal, and it was during that afternoon's conversation that I must have asked her, or maybe she volunteered it, that really how she's coped with her new life, with that sort of background. And I remember she said that she was able to detach herself completely from the war years and her experience, and that she would not entertain any involvement in emotional things about the past. In fact, she said to me that she pretended it didn't happen, that she wouldn't allow her brain to take it in. That is what she said, because if she would allow her brain to take it in, she said she couldn't go on living. So she drew a blind over those years and stood in front of it to start this new life in Birmingham. And so that was interesting, and I wondered really at the time how it was that she still had this memorabilia about her in the house, really to act as, I suppose, a daily reminder with a ritual of cutting up a slice of bread every day, to remind her of the things that, in fact, she said, didn't exist in her mind. She knew they existed, but she locked them off. So that was interesting. And I went back much later than I expected on a train back to London, and I was worried because I didn't think that Yorkshire probably wouldn't let me make this film anyway because it didn't fit into the Women of Courage concept. But I was worried because I didn't really know enough about it, but to take a survivor back, I thought there was a risk. There was a risk, there are two risks really, one big one, and that is, could it damage a person? What effect would that return have on her? And the other one, on a smaller scale, but also I thought about the possible accusations of media manipulation, that for the sake of sort of good television, you just pick a survivor and take them back to Auschwitz. So I put that problem to one side, and we'd agreed I'd come back 2 days later. And I got to know her pretty well, and the more I heard, and from Kitty you hear a great deal, and the more I heard, the more I realized that this story has got to be done. You know, she's got to go back. And then I discovered about her family life. She'd married and had two sons, David, a doctor, and Peter, who's here tonight. He was then in aeronautics, working for the aerospace industry, if I remember rightly. I haven't seen him for 25 years. It was good to see him again tonight. And then I thought, maybe if I could somehow persuade a member of the family to come back with her to Auschwitz, that would reduce that risk that I feared that would have to be taken. So the next time I came down, we talked about it. She'd, if I remember rightly, taking the boys when they were young to Germany on holiday. She didn't want them to be German haters, as she put it. And then I said, do the boys ever, have they ever said that they would like to visit Auschwitz to find out how their mother and their grandmother lived and survived in that place? And she said, yes, probably David would. And so I thought, well, maybe this is a lifeline. And I said, would David come with you for this film? And she jumped out of her settee and dived to the telephone and dialed a number and thrust the receiver into my hand. And I picked it up, and there was a very gruff voice which says, who's that? Because what she didn't tell me was that he was doing, I think they were final medical exams or something like that, in Saskatchewan on the west coast of Canada. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. And so I had some very swift explaining to do. And when I told him the story that Yorkshire Television wanted to make this film, that his mother was very keen to go back there, that I was very reluctant to take her on her own, would he come? And all he said, and he brightened up, he said, give me a date and send me the tickets and I'll be with you. And that really, as far as at a stroke, reduced to a minimum the risk that I had feared. So I said, Kitty, I think we are on. I've got to persuade Yorkshire Television to let me do this. So I went to see my old friend Paul Fox, who was managing director at Yorkshire, and I explained it to him. And in the end, he said, it sounds like a very good idea. I said, it can't be part of the Women of Courage series, although I'm shooting them all at the same time. I will give you four Women of Courage. It was going to be six. You just do four, but I'll give you a 90-minute slot to do a separate program about the survivor who you want to take back to Auschwitz. And that is how Women of Courage became separated from Kitty returned to Auschwitz, and there were four of those. There was a Swede, a Pole, a German, and a Brit, and they each made their own contributions for these one-hour slots. Anyway, I then decided, and I went with Kevin Sim to Auschwitz. I wanted to do a reconnaissance of the place. I wanted to find out, you know, excuse me, how we were going to approach this. The Polish authorities in charge were extremely helpful. And we arrived outside Auschwitz-Birkenau, that big, ugly, huge block with a big watchtower at the top. And we climbed to the top of that. And I think that first impression I got left a lasting impression on me. It really almost blew my mind because I'd never thought of Auschwitz in what size it was. As far as the eye could see, there was Auschwitz-Birkenau. And I'd seen many documentaries, and I'd seen many other movies and fictional things, but somehow the size of the place was never stressed. I think these statistics were always about people. It was always about head counts, always about millions, never about acres. And then it occurred to me that if you want to build an establishment which has an intake of millions of people at one end and to reduce them to ashes at the other end, you need a pretty big place. And I was determined that somehow, I didn't know whether I've succeeded, but I was determined somehow that I would try and reflect that brutal, obscene size of that place in the film, which is not easy on the small television screen. So I came back to England and then decided the best way, the style had to be decided. How was I going to capture this? And I thought that Yorkshire Television, there's some colleagues there who said, why don't you take an interviewer or a reporter or a journalist? And I said, no, I don't want to introduce an extraneous person to that, because here we've got really potentially something going for us. There's nothing better than a mother telling her son what she and her mother did to live and survive this dreadful place. And by this time, I'd got to know Kitty well enough to realize that she was most eloquent and, what's more, unstoppable once she started. And I thought here was the right sort of chemistry between those two that ought to work. Now, in order to capture that, one has got to use, I suppose it's called a technique or a style, which is simply observational filming, or it used to be called, at still is a bit, it's called cinema verite. That is where you have got a very small, discrete film unit, and you hope, fingers crossed, that the subjects you are filming are so engrossed by what they're doing that they become oblivious of the camera. If that happens, then you strike gold. If that doesn't happen, you've got a real problem. And in order to do that, the technique, the technical side of it is really very simple. In order to keep that film crew inconspicuous and small, I had a cameraman and a sound recordist and myself, and we were all linked with cans because they were going to wear radio microphones so that we could all hear what Kitty and David were saying, and we could hear them at a distance of about, I think, 150 yards or 200 yards. So I could then whisper into the cameraman's ear, said, go in, zoom in, let's follow them, and so on. And there was another assistant cameraman who was heavily laden with film magazines and batteries because we were going to be miles away from the camera truck, which was parked outside the main gate, and we were going to be there all day, and I simply just did not want to break off in order to reload magazines and that sort of thing. So that is then how we started to operate. And the next thing was to go to Krakow, and we all stayed, believe it or not, at the Holiday Inn in Krakow, which to me was not a very appropriate name for a residence, but there we were. And we met that night for dinner. David, I think, had flown to Warsaw and picked up Kitty there, and they came down to, is that right, they came down to Krakow. And there, over dinner, I had to brief Kitty. And I had to say, you're going to get a very early call in the morning. Please wear some thick clothes. She didn't have to be told that, because she knows that in November, Auschwitz can be bitterly cold. It's just before the snow comes. And then you will go by taxi to Auschwitz. That was the only transport we had. Can you believe it? We had to hire a taxi to take her to Auschwitz-Birkenau, which I think is, I know, 40 miles. It's quite a long journey. And I said that you would be stopped about half a mile short of the main gate of Auschwitz-Birkenau by our sound recordist, or assistant sound recordist, and he will bug you up. You know, they will put the microphones and then send you off, and the driver had been instructed to then take you to the main gate and drop you there. And then I said to them, now you will probably not see me, because we are going to be very inconspicuous, very discreet. I won't tell you what to do or what not to do. I won't tell you where to go or where not to go. I won't give you any instructions There won't be any rehearsals. There won't be any retakes. There won't be any cueing. No prompting. In fact, I'm not going to speak to you at all. And that is what happened. Then, while we were filming, I never spoke to Kitty. And so that was then understood that night, and I must say I had two sets of fingers crossed, hoping that it would work. Now, the film you're going to see now has a prologue, which is just setting very briefly Kitty's background and also her preparation of going back after 32 years. As she said, she really wanted to find confirmation that it really happened. And then there's the film, and at the end there's an epilogue where we spoke to her at her home in Birmingham several weeks after her return, really to tie a knot into this visit. So that's the film, and then we'll hopefully get questions and answers afterwards. Thanks.
I think it's very difficult to know quite how to follow that film, which really is extraordinary. I think the microphones aren't working, actually. Could we perhaps have the microphones switched on?
Bring them a bit closer.
Hello? I think that's...
No? Yeah.
Have I just got one that's not working, maybe?
Just lift it up a little bit.
That's better. Thank you. We now have, I think... 20 minutes or so in which to put questions to Kitty Hart and Peter Morley. And I must introduce on my very far left Toby Haggith, who is the film programmer in the museum's film archive. Now, I wonder if I could perhaps start, and then I'd like to open the questions to the audience. But I